Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Consider the worm tongues in Washington and elsewhere all around the country, spinning their stories. Worm tongues, unctuous, oily. They're not speaking directly. As Judge Amy Coney Barrett goes before the Senate Judiciary Committee for hearings on her appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. And oh yes, the worm tongues are quite busy now. They're already going after her Roman Catholic faith again, her family of seven children again, two of them adopted from Haiti. But the worm tongues aren't finished. On the most significant issue facing the American Republic, the issue of Democrats wanting to pack the Supreme Court and expand its size beyond nine justices, Joe Biden says voters don't deserve to know his position on the matter. Just repeating here, when a reporter in tech in Las Vegas asked him, "Don't the voters deserve to know where you stand on court packing?" "No, they don't deserve," Biden snapped.
Sir, I've got to ask you about packing the courts. And I know that you said yesterday you aren't going to answer the question until after the election. But this is the number one thing that I've been asked about from viewers in the past couple of days.
Well, you've been asked by the viewers who are probably Republicans who don't want me continuing to talk about what they're doing to the court right now.
Well, sir, don't the voters deserve to know
where you stand? No, they don't. I'm not going to play his game.
You're not going to tell us? We don't deserve to know, Joe? You sound just like a political boss of the 1960s in Chicago. You know, the city of shut up and take it. But even Richard J. Daley wouldn't have tried to answer that way. And consider the wormiest worm tongue of all, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who asked her a few years ago in that unctuous, oily voice of his whether Amy Coney Barrett was a Orthodox Christian.
Do you consider yourself an Orthodox Catholic?
I am a Catholic, Senator Durbin. I don't, Orthodox Catholic, we kind of, as I said in that article, we just kind of use that as a proxy. It is not, to my knowledge, you know, a term currently in use, but if you're asking whether I take my faith seriously and I'm a faithful Catholic, I am, although I would stress that my personal church affiliation or my religious belief would not bear on the discharge of my duties as a judge.
Remember that? Well, on NBC's Meet the Press the other day, before the hearings began, he got his worm tongue working.
American people have watched the Republicans pack in the court over the last 3.5 years, and they brag about it. They've taken every vacancy and filled it.
That's a worm tongue for you. It's not true. When President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court and didn't have the votes in the Senate, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader, said he would delay it, I supported the delay. I didn't support it for partisan reasons. I supported it because I wanted the people to decide the issue. And guess what? No matter what the worm tongues are talking about or saying now, they decided the issue. The issue of Garland and the court was front and center in the presidential campaign of 2016. Then-candidate Donald Trump put out a list of conservative judges he'd appoint if there was a vacancy. I'm still waiting for the list of judges Biden would appoint, but I guess we don't deserve to know, right, Joe? Anyway, Trump won that election in 2016. The Republicans won the majority and then increased their majority on the issue of the Supreme Court in 2018. So the people had spoken. But the worm tongues in politics and in media are trying to conflate. What Trump and the Republicans are doing is constitutional. The president appoints, and the Congress either does not support or walk away from or turn their backs or vote on it. That's what the Constitution provides. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the president, any president, doesn't stop being the president after 3 years. And now Amy Coney Barrett finds herself surrounded by the worm tongues of Washington. We'll talk today to Douglas Kamek, the former Obama appointee ambassador to Malta and a legal scholar, and Amy Coney Barrett's law professor in her first year at law school at Notre Dame. Jeff Carlin is here with me as always, and Jeff's got some news. Yeah, Jeff and Christine are finally getting married. And I'm John Cass, out here on the back stoop of the Chicago Three Flat, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And you, with just 3 weeks to go in the most important election of your lifetime, with the worm tongues in full wormy cry, you're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
The other day I wrote a column about Amy Coney Barrett. She's going to be up before the United States Senate in a confirmation battle, and I hope that she does well and is not subject to the outrage and hatred that the last justice experienced. And in that, I got a letter from a former teacher of hers, and I wanted you to hear it. His name is Douglas Kamek, professor, ambassador to Malta, professor at Notre Dame for years, lawyer, a White House fellow, and a distinguished Fulbright scholar. He's done it all, and now he's on the Chicago Way. Hello, Professor Kamek. How are you?
Good morning, John. I'm fine. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on with Jeff and me.
Yes, good morning.
Professor, what do you expect Amy Coney Barrett, Judge Amy Coney Barrett from the Seventh Circuit here in Chicago, will go through during this hearing? What's it going to be like for her? I mean, you had to be confirmed as an ambassador, but it's just a different deal. You know, people didn't hate you for what you represented.
Yeah, that's right. And unfortunately, as you indicated, it has become a partisan habit to attack the character of people nominated for the judiciary. And that, John, in itself is a revelation as to why Judge Barrett's confirmation is so needed. The reason behind the hatred and the partisanship is that for too long, people have gotten into the habit of thinking of judges as an additional policy-making body as opposed to those who interpret the laws that the legislature, the real policy-making body, makes. Amy Coney Barrett has a profound understanding of the correct role of the judiciary, and that's why it's so important that she not be subjected to personal denigration or any other scurrilous attack that would distract from the importance of the appointment.
The fact that the, for lack of a better word, originalists or textualists do not legislate from the bench but try to interpret the Constitution as it was written, how does that threaten the whole left world order? And I don't mean it in terms of particular legislation, you know, that I want someone to be on the court to represent my views. I don't want someone on the court to represent my views. I don't want them to do what I want in terms of legislation. All I want them to do is
think about what the founders had in mind when they wrote the articles that keep us going as a republic. And what does that mean when people feel threatened by it?
Well, because they've been given the misimpression that one can pour anything into the Constitution, even if it's not there, things that have that as their origin, abortion rights, the whole series of cases dealing with same-sex marriage and so forth, these are all things that come out of aspects of the mind of judges at that particular time with very little anchor in the words of the Constitution whatsoever. And so if that is the case, and you appoint judges who return to the language and the understanding of the Constitution at the time it was ratified, or if we're talking about statutes, the democratic choices that may have been made last year or the year before in the incorporation of meaning into the U.S. Code. You have, if you're going to have a judiciary that has the capacity to invalidate the actions of both the executive and the legislature, and you want democracy, well, then you have to have a judiciary that respects democratic choices. And that is why it is so much perceived to be a battle royale, because those particular rights have become popular or have been popularly asserted, have originated not in the legislature, not in the Congress, not in the ratification of the Constitution, but in the minds of a few justices. And when you have that, you no longer have the rule of law. You have substituted the rule of men and women for the rule of law. And that's not the nature of our republic.
And there's a lot of perceived worry, I guess there was a word for it, that a judge would be indebted to someone else for putting her in a position. Can you speak to that? Because that's something that I've always questioned, but in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, the best jurists know that that's not their job.
That's exactly right. It is not their job. And the tradition of judges wearing gowns, by the way, on the bench, was a symbolic statement that when they, even though they originated out of politics, all people in the government do, they are to set aside politics and partisanship and previous loyalties, and to, as the judicial oath recites, that they are to give justice with equal measure to rich and poor alike. And it's entirely legitimate for the Congress to inquire whether a judicial candidate is under someone's influence, and they are not going to be able to set aside that partisan nature. But what is not appropriate is for people to indicate that they want particular outcomes, and they're only appointing judge to get that particular outcome. And Amy Coney Barrett and all others who have been successfully appointed in this administration, and I think generally, have convinced the Senate of the United States that they are people of integrity that will set aside their own personal views in order to give, again, the honest statement of what the laws that were passed mean, or what the Constitution meant when it was ratified. So you have to have confidence in the people you appoint. And where do you get that confidence from? Well, you look at their record, you look at their training, you get some sense of who they were or who they are in their community. And that's the best we can do. But that process gets distorted when it becomes like a political campaign and the judges are thought to be guaranteeing a particular slate of results or a particular menu of policy outcomes. Again, Amy Coney Barrett, as all good judicial nominees, is exactly the opposite of that. She's saying, give me the cases as they arise. Don't give them to me in the confirmation hearing and expect me to give you a list of particular outcomes, because you can't really judge a case until you know its facts, until you read its particular briefs, until it's put in entire context. And then, of course, there's all sorts of canons of interpretation that require you to write as narrowly as possible, so that you don't overjudge, if you will, make one case into a general statement that is too general and it needs to be responded to on a case-by-case basis.
One thing that I think people should understand, and I wonder if you could speak to this before we get to her, Judge Barrett herself, is that if I want judges to give me a particular outcome on legislation, then I have to be prepared. If I want a court like that, I have to be prepared for when the political pendulum swings and, say, another politics is introduced, and other justices will then willy-nilly read the Constitution and add rights or take rights away, affecting me and you and everyone else. They have to understand that the reason why we have the Constitution and why we want people to be cautious about it and not add rights is because all right, you can then take away rights and you can create new ones that'll conflict with others. I mean, don't they understand that? Don't the politicians in Washington, particularly the senators, know what they're setting up for the country as they push this kind of perversity?
I think many of them don't realize that. And because they tend to see their decision-making horizons as quite short. They want something today, and they get it today, and they go back to their constituents and say, see what I've done for you, kind of thing. But it is very transient, and it is corrosive. It corrupts the whole idea of a rule of law as opposed to this rule that is good for one day and one day only, and something else is going to be the law on the next day. And if you think about that just from a policy perspective, it ruins all chances of certainty, and it gives rise to its own body of dispute because nothing is ever firmly established as a boundary. You can say in every case, well, it is true that we said X last time, but I'm feeling a little bit more like Y today, so I'm going to put that out there. And, you know, that's not ordered law, that's chaos. And one of the things we've come to see in the most serious disputes in our lifetime, whether they be disputes over how to count the ballots and Bush versus Gore, or disputes about personal liberties, is that if you say that everything is up for grabs, you're not going to have a life that's going to encourage people to invest their life savings in new businesses or in establishing new communities. Because why give up your lifetime treasure and your personal time if it's also fleeting and transient? We need a court as an arbiter to protect us from people in the political branches who would overreach. And thankfully, in many occasions in the past, we've had that, but that's because we've chosen men and women who have lived up to their judicial responsibilities.
We are speaking to Douglas Kmeck, Ambassador to Malta, Professor of Law at Notre Dame and other law schools, a long and distinguished career in the law. And I'm going to read, if I may, just a line from a note I received from you, Professor. Your column this morning on the reasons why the left opposes the very excellent Amy Comey Barrett is right on target. Over 20 years ago, I taught Amy in her first year studies at Notre Dame. The light of her intellect and the joy of her soul have gone on to inspire many in the law. It was once said, teachers affect eternity, never knowing where their influence stops. I can't think of a better person to talk to about her than someone who taught her in that first terrifying year of law school at Notre Dame. So what did you notice about her?
You did notice a determination, persistence of the light of knowledge, not only that she had already accumulated in her fine studies before she came to Notre Dame, but in her desire to know and to examine questions from all sorts of different perspectives and to state answers and propositions in ways that were alluringly persuasive and well-reasoned. And I use the word joy in responding to your fine column, John, and I think that's the thing I remember most about her in class, is that the most terrifying problem, and as you relate, some people do find the first year of law school, maybe even the second and the third, to be terrifying. That was not the manner of Amy Coney Barrett. She embraced the unknown and the challenges and the hard historical digging that it sometimes takes to identify the real meaning of a provision in the Constitution or elsewhere. And I even had her for some classes that are not known as the sexiest classes on the agenda. One of the things first year students take at Notre Dame is courses in real property. Well, as you might guess, there's very, very few late night programs with real property at the center of their script writing. But they and many of the problems about succession and so forth in terms of ownership and title and things of that nature can be determined by laws that go back centuries. Many students say, well, why do I have to learn this? And where is this going? And Amy was a person who would say, just embrace it. Just see how a culture grows out of the law. And you will learn and you will thrive. And you will be carrying on a tradition that is very, very important to the well-being of our country. And I remember in particular, teachers remember students in different ways. One of the ways I seem to be haunted with is I can remember where people sat in a particular classroom. And I can remember teaching on one given day, a rule that all law students come to detest. It's called the rule against perpetuities. And it's an arcane piece of a doctrine from the common law that prevents people from tying up real property with too many covenants or encumbrances or restrictions. And it has a very almost algorithm or a complicated formula for working out what interest can survive and what interest can't. Amy figured all that out. And not only that, she identified in the casebook where the author, a very distinguished author, and I'm happy to say in this instance it wasn't me, the author had made a mistake. And and had propounded an answer that Amy demonstrated conclusively could not be. So one knew immediately in that early classroom two things. Amy loved the law, and she was not hesitant at all to take on the most difficult problems, and often, because of her intellect, show the way to a better answer.
The faculty at Notre Dame and the life at Notre Dame is not spread out over a gigantic metropolitan area. And I would think that law professors and any professors, like their colleagues, if they want to think in those terms, their colleagues who might be soccer coaches or athletic coaches, when you see one, you know, when you see one on the field, you can't, when I see, I would see a young reporter who I could see had that spark, at least to try to learn it. You'd get excited and you'd tell your friends, I found one. Did you folks at Notre Dame Watts say that Amy Coney Barrett, keep an eye on her? Anyone talk about her like that?
Yes, and indeed, that's part of her special quality as well. As you know, she's the mother of seven, which in around Notre Dame is a small family. And two of those children, of course, came from Haiti out of difficult circumstances. But here's Amy Coney Barrett and her husband, Jesse. Of course, I knew her when she was Amy Coney, and but both of them were students at the Notre Dame Law School, starting a family. And you do, because it's a small town, you do get to see people at the soccer games and the softball tournaments, and certainly all of the various activities on campus. And you would see Amy there as well, and you would see her then in an entirely different way, but consistent. Just as she loved the life and the law and the life of her studies, you would see, and people will see them today, the Barretts today, you know, bringing the same oranges for the halftime refreshment of the book. And when you have seven children going back and forth across town,
need a van
to try and make a few minutes of every child's expertise, and you admire, well, obviously you admire anybody who can carry off those responsibilities in modern life as a mother and a father and as a distinguished jurist or academic. You admire somebody who has the calm and the presence of mind to carry all those functions off. And you just like, you're drawn to the person because you admire how well they've taken on life, even when life throws them a curve or something that's, you know, unhappy or unwanted, like the discovery of a disability or things of that nature. So, yes, people would see them and they would know them as quality people. That's why one of the things I hope doesn't happen in this confirmation, but I see it's incipiently happening already, is to take on Amy's faith.
Yes, that's sickening.
She is a woman of great faith, and she belonged to a small Catholic group here called the People of Praise. And I know them because they're associated with one of the finest schools in the country that just happens to be in South Bend because they created it here. And that's a school called Trinity School. And it's a school that has a very rigorous curriculum built around the great books and the study of Latin and the study of mathematics in the original. You know, you just don't get a textbook with problems. You read the real Euclid and so forth. And you might think, well, gee, that's kind of an elitist school. That would be for the extremely capable and, you know, well provided for. Well, the idea that Amy and her friends had in establishing that school and in working for it, you know, as a parent, was that it would be for everybody, all ranges of ability. And indeed, that's the way they conduct it. And it's, you know, from good people, great things come. And the Trinity School has been a lasting blessing for many, many families in South Bend. And it has been a blessing well beyond, you know, just a handful of very highly talented people. And, but more than that, it was a place established so that whatever your faith tradition was, you didn't have to be Catholic, you didn't have to be of a part, you didn't have to be part of the people of praise. All were welcomed. And the point I'm trying to make is that Amy Coney is so superior a person, there's going to be very few skeletons in that closet. And the skeletons that are there aren't going to be very scary. But more importantly than that, we have provisions in the Constitution that have to be observed in the questioning. And those provisions are in the First Amendment that Congress can't make any laws prohibiting the free exercise of religious faith or respecting the establishment of a religious faith. And there is a provision in the original Constitution that a religious test oath for service in a public office shall never be allowed. Well, I hope those two provisions are kept in mind as the senators are asking questions, because there was a temptation when she was nominated to the appellate bench to try and use her religious faith, her Catholic faith, to disqualify her.
It was sickening, Professor. Are you or ever have been a Catholic, or are you an Orthodox Catholic? That was Durbin and Feinstein with the famous... the dogma speaks loudly within you. I couldn't believe that. They would never ask this of people of other faith. They would never dare. Why do they think that it's okay to attack Roman Catholicism? And as I'm speaking as a truly Orthodox Christian, since I am, you know, two lungs, one body, said the Pope. But why do they think they can get away with it?
Well, as you said, it's disgusting. And I would make the further point to say that it's, in my judgment, it's unconstitutional. It's certainly behavior that is contrary to the Constitution because of the provisions that I just mentioned. The founders did not want our country to be sectarian, but they wanted to express the view that religion was an important aspect of life that needed to be respected so that people could freely make up their own mind as to how they prayed and how they conceived of God and so forth. If we take that away and we make that a disqualifier, if we make what George Washington said in his farewell address was essential to the country's success and prosperity going into the future, if we take that away, we can't expect to be the same country after that. We've really fallen into serious error, and I hope the Senate avoids that this week. They will be tempted. There, you can see the lines already being planted in the media. They will be tempted to go the opposite way, but I hope there's people on the committee who will say, no, we're not going down that route.
Should they, whatever route they go down, they will try to, they would try to undercut her. I mean, they feel that's their job. Rather than try to understand her point of view and express it, and allow it to be expressed and discuss it and even challenge it, which is their right and obligation before the people, they would, I just feel that there's going to be a cheap kind of politics. And at the same time this is going on, for the purposes of this podcast, just the other day, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris continue to stall, deflect, not talk about whether or not they would back adding more Supreme Court justices if the Democrats take the Senate and if they're elected to the White House. I find this to be curious and depressing, but I wanted to ask you, Professor, what do you make of it? And what do you make of this court packing talk?
Well, it happened once before, as you know, John, and it was 1936. And the person who tried it was none other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who at the time was a revered president because the nation was in the depths of the worst depression that it had ever known. Millions of people were out of work, and Roosevelt was a bit frustrated in his attempts to get various New Deal agencies sanctioned as constitutional within the scope of the powers of Congress. And he thought the way to get around this was he would be greatly expanding the court so that he would have a working majority. Well, notice when you're doing that, the express purpose of doing that is basically to turn the court further into a political entity. You're not adding people to the court because they're overworked or because they can't get their work done on time, or because there is some neutral criteria that is crying out for assistance. You're doing it just to get a particular outcome. Well, anybody can stack the deck and then say, well, this is the way the law played out. Well, that's not really true, is it? And it's so political in its nature that when Roosevelt put it forth before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1936, he was excoriated. Here was the man who was revered for his courage in the face of economic depression, basically being told, we like you. We affirm the things you're trying to do to help us get past this difficult moment in our history, but we will not allow you to dismantle the bedrock principles of our Constitution. And we can think of no way in which that would happen more quickly than if we were to allow you to pack the court. And it's, as you said before, it's an effervescent notion. Even if you were able to pack the court for a given time, for a given outcome, you don't know where that will turn around and bite you the next time, because somebody else will be packing the court in an opposite direction, and then we'll just simply have this partisan football that will be kicked back and forth rather than an independent body that is assessing the laws fairly. You know, sometimes we use the term rule of law without really knowing what's behind it.
Yes,
we have a feel about it, but we can't put it into words. And the way the great founders put it into words was to say the law was written and known in advance, it was enforced by an impartial judiciary, and it was capable of being enforced in an even-handed way applicable to all. And for law to have those essential aspects, you can't do that with a body that is being expanded and contracted to give you particular outcomes.
But the difference was, if I may, that in the 30s there were Democrats and there was the left. There were Democrats in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and when I was in the 60s and 70s when I was a little boy, who were not of the hard left. And our family was, I guess, part of that Democratic thing. But many say the Democrats, I didn't leave the Democrats left me. And I can see that too. throughout my life, and I see how hard left it's become and how outcome-driven and how supportive of the administrative state at all costs and the Congress not doing its job writing laws and turning the judiciary into their mini legislature and all that. And I wonder, would there be such a pushback today by people on the Democratic side that there were, that there was in the 1930s when Roosevelt tried it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a one that I can only express a hope as an answer to, and that is, one would certainly hope that we have not lost the significance of our third branch, our independent judiciary, so greatly that we wouldn't be willing to stand up and defend it. But I have a sense of what you're talking about. This is going a little bit off script now, but when I was a youngster in 1960, my dad used to take me around to his political meetings because he was part of the Democratic Party campaigning for John Kennedy at the time. And I remember being a nine-year-old boy having a button on my chest that said, if I was 21, I'd vote for Kennedy. And the Kennedy of those days, I mean, the Democratic Party of those days, of John Kennedy, of Robert Kennedy, was a party of the working man, was a party that understood the significance of what it meant to be free, and was not the party of, well, extremism in any way. It was the party that said, well, we can move this country in the same way that an ant can move a rubber tree plant, as I remember.
Yes, that was a popular sign of the time, yeah.
So there was a culture at that time that really was very admirable on both the Democratic and the Republican side. There were differences between the parties, but there was bedrock belief in the American tradition and its institutions. Sometimes when you hear various political figures, sometimes on both sides these days, you wonder if they have the same appreciation for that. But the way to make sure that we keep it is to make good appointments to the judicial branch and, quite frankly, as good appointments or elections as we can find among our own neighbors to run for political office and to engage in public service, not to make money for themselves or to assuage their egos, but because it's important to have good people doing the smallest task and the greatest task. Without them, you quickly forget who you were. There was a writer thousands of years ago, of course, Cicero, who said, the Constitution is like a fine painting. And when it's delivered over to you, you have a choice. You can either keep the colors fresh and vibrant and the painting in good condition, or you can let it decline. And Cicero told us that it was very important to keep that painting fresh in every single moment of its existence. And I think he's right.
On the point of the Constitution and the idea of this expansion and contraction of the Supreme Court, do you think there's anything to the idea that the people would then push on their elected officials to proffer up an amendment to the Constitution to stop that from happening, and thus the Constitution would fulfill its role as the representative and guide rail for the people?
Well, I think in many ways there's already a constitutional challenge to it without having to amend the Constitution to stop it. You'd get a little bit of debate on this, appropriately so. You know, they're talking about not just expanding the Constitution, the number of justices. That's pretty much a statutory question. And as you know, it has been different from time to time. At one point it was 10, at another point it was 6. But it has been 9 for some 150 years now. So you talk about statutory precedent, that's a pretty good precedent. But it's not a constitutional limit. But some of the other things that are talked about are not just expanding the numbers on the bench, but have imposing term limits. And of course, if you start talking about term limits, you start running across the limitation in the Constitution that judges, including the justices on the Supreme Court, serve for good behavior, which has come to mean that they serve for life so long as they're observing their ethical responsibilities and they're capable of performing their job. So they're, depending on how the proposal is written, there's a constitutional stop already in the document that would prevent removing justices from office before they chose to resign. And that's part of, again, the founders knew what they were doing. If you could tell a particular justice, well, we're going to term limit you out in a particular time and place, well, you're going to have a justice that is going to be calculating in his mind, well, what do I have to rule here in order to keep my job? And you don't want judges to be making decisions on the basis of their own personal well-being. And so the founders secured against that by providing the service for life. But, and as to finding new constitutional limits, well, let's remember one thing, and that is the Constitution has only been amended 27 times. It's been, that is something that is reserved for the, for cases that are highly inappropriate. So I wouldn't want to think about amending the Constitution too easily, because it's sometimes you invite other things to get tossed into the mix, and then you end up with a situation that's even worse.
Professor, I can't thank you enough for spending so much time with us. And the only thing I think Jeff, me, and probably everybody listening to is that we wish we could be sitting around a table with you with a cup of coffee and just be able to talk with you forever on these subjects. I'm so lucky that I get to do this for a living, and I can't thank you enough for spending your time with us and helping, I guess, get beyond headlines and partisanship and get beyond all that to talk about the nature of our country and our Constitution. So thank you so much, sir. Are you going to be watching these hearings? Are you going to go to Washington? What are you?
I'm going to stay here safely in South Bend in my behind my mask and everything else. But I will be watching, and what I hope to see is reasoned judgment, fair-minded questions, and I think the country would feel better about itself if, having found this wonderful lawyer and mother and contributor to her community, that instead of tearing the person down or finding some mysterious witness that says, well, she didn't tie her shoes properly on some day, that we instead rejoice in the notion that America still produces people of this quality. And people who can even figure out arcane property issues from the rule against perpetuities. So I thank you both, Jeff and John, for the opportunity to talk to my hometown. I miss Chicago, but I feel that Notre Dame and South Bend is a pretty unique place too. And anytime you want that cup of coffee, you know where to find me.
I'll just stop at Racine Bakery and get you a bag of bacon buns and make the drive over so you can have the old neighborhood on the plate.
There you go.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. For Douglas William Kamek, professor at Notre Dame and other law schools, former ambassador to Malta, voted for Obama, a conservative voting for Obama, and appointed to the Foreign Service by Obama. He is the Caruso Family Chair and Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine. And he spent an hour with us talking in the most sincere terms about the nature of the law
the nature of Amy Coney Barrett and the nature of our Constitution and how to keep it, or the Republic and how to keep it. And I can't thank him enough. And for my buddy and soon-to-be newlywed, Jeff Carlin, Jeff and Christine Carlin, apparently. And for me, I'm John Cass, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board, father of two, husband to one. Love you all, and thank you for being here. And join us again, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.